Kale and Company, weekday mornings, 6 till 10.
My next guest, I mean, you know what? You could take that philosophy in life, train hard and fight easy. That means he's a medical doctor, and you got to train real hard so that when you get in there to do surgery and work with the patient, you're ready to go. So I'm going to be bringing on, let me give you a little bit of background, Dr. Lewis Keeler. He's with Summit Urology, which is a division of Summit Health, and they have offices here in South Jersey. And Dr. Lou has been practicing for 39 years, and he specializes in prostate cancers. And I thought Dr. Lou would be good to come on for two reasons. And the first reason is we're going to kind of do a public service announcement about, you know, for men and about the prostate. And at the same time, I'm going to want to talk to Dr. Lou about the recent diagnosis with President Biden. He has prostate cancer now. This came out about a week ago, and it has metastasized into his bones, which is that's a tough stuff. And no one's going to know more about that than Dr. Lou. So, Dr. Lou, I want to welcome you to 1210.
Good morning, Tom.
How are you, Dr. Lou?
Doing great. Happy Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day to you. So, you know, before, you know, I have a couple of questions for you before we get into the politics. I actually called this prostate and politics segment. But before I rather do, I want to ask you a couple of questions, just like I am a regular guy and as a patient, but when it comes to the prostate and getting, going to see your doctor about it, what age do you recommend men start getting screened?
Well, our organization, the American Urologic Association, recommends screening by age 50, and in higher risk patients with family history of prostate cancer, or African-American men, even 45 or younger.
And there's two tests that they give you, and there's the PSA blood test, and then there's the digital rectal exam. Are both of these something that once when you get to 50, should you be getting both of these once a year? Is that the recommendation?
Well, the PSA for sure, and most of us still also do a digital rectal exam on entry, although it's not quite as important as it used to be. But most things start with PSA screening at age 50, and the intervals can vary after that from 1 to 2 years, or possibly even more, depending on what your initial PSA is and your overall risk factors. But 1 year is a good starting point.
Yeah, so I can't even remember how long. I've been doing it. So I go regularly to a urologist, and, you know, obviously even my general practitioner, he does the PSA blood test, then he sends it over to the urologist, and he does the digital exam every year, too. And That's just like part of my normal routine every year. But I have the question because I've had like some discussions with friends. Like, you know, a lot of men are uncomfortable with that. But this is where the question's going to come from. But I hope some ladies are listening to this too, because if your boyfriend or your husband, you know, if you hear this, you can encourage them, because this is a disease, Dr. Lou, that you if you catch it early, you can control it, and there's so much treatment for it. But early detection is key. Is that correct?
That is correct, and sometimes we don't treat it. Actually, low risk prostate cancer, which can be 25 or 30% of prostate cancer, we sometimes do something called active surveillance, where we keep a close eye on you with periodic PSA tests, imaging, other tests, and periodic biopsies. In the hopes that you won't progress, and many of these patients never need therapy. On the other hand, we want to prevent metastatic disease like what's happened recently, so we do want early identification.
And here's another question. It's kind of like an awkward question. Like, my friends would be like, oh, I don't want to, you know, I know my doctor, he's my, you know, my internist or my GP. Like, I always say to them, like, just go to a urologist, first of all. And this, when you go to a urologist, when they do the exam that men are so uncomfortable about, it literally lasts no more than 2 or 3 seconds. And I always say that, The urologist does this so much. He knows what to feel for. It's very quick. It's painless. It's done so quick. It's like, it's not awkward. It's just, you just get it done. And so, like, I guess my question is it good to just, is it okay if your internist does it, or are you really better off going to a, to the physician? That's his specialty. He knows what to feel for, and he go, and he's, you know, you just, is very efficient. Is there a difference?
Well, probably. We're certainly okay if the internist skips it and sends it to us.
Yeah.
We're okay with that.
Yeah, no, I actually.
So sometimes we hate to see somebody have it. It is, being the same age as you, Tom, relatively, it's a little uncomfortable, and, so we'd rather just have one as opposed to two.
Yeah, no, I get it. That's and that's how I've been operating, and this is what men need to do, and a lot of men are afraid of doctors. You know that, Dr. Lou.
Absolutely, we recommend that, like I said, age 50, get that initial PSA. If it's very low, you may not need that much screening. On the other hand, if it's normal but mildly elevated, you should be seeing urology.
Absolutely. It's it's funny. My wife marches off to the doctor like it's no big deal. But for me, and I believe me, I'm very, I do everything I have to. But there is like an emotional thing for guys going to the doctors. And so if you do feel that way, you're hesitant or whatever, just get it done. Just do it and march forward. But there is men have like a psychological thing about doctors. Not all men. But I know a lot of the guys I run with, they're like, I got to go to the doctor like it's the end of the world. But you got to do it, and you got to get it done. So let's move into with President Biden. Were you surprised with this diagnosis of prostate cancer that now is metastasized to his bones? Is it like what, if you're sitting home watching the news, you're not like, this is your profession. You know the ins and outs of this. What's your first reaction when you heard it?
I was surprised because he's president or former president of the United States. And I was surprised to learn that he wasn't getting regular PSA screening after age 72. And by the way, when his doctor recommended to stop screening, which is what we heard happened. Of course, we don't know everything. It wasn't inappropriate at that time. He was 72. I just sort of felt like, wow, he's vice president or president, we should make them get screened regardless of the regular rules for you and I.
Yeah. So his last test, because I actually started doing the timing on this. So his last test was in 2014. So he still has 2 years left as the vice president. He's a heartbeat away from the presidency. I guess he's, they go to Walter Reed. They do, they get their annual checkups and physicals every year. He's 71 years old. Today he's 82. So he had not had a PSA test for 11 years as one of the most, powerful men in the world. It's very unusual.
I think it's different for presidents and now, of course, American popes. They should get screened a lot. I mean, and 71, he was a pretty, as I recall, pretty vigorous, too. And we don't do much PSA, new PSA testing at 80, really.
Right.
We're mostly following people, or people have stopped screening by then. So, but his problem didn't start this year, unbeknownst to him, apparently, this thing was percolating for at least 3 to 5 years. And I don't know how it was affecting him. So it's a little surprising because he was vice president and president. But it sounds like he's listening to his doctor, but I think most of us would agree to hold a different standard for our high-level executives in screening.
Absolutely. Let me, there's, obviously the talk in the political circles and in the public is that, he looked like he was weak and he was tired and, obviously he had the debate where he seemed totally out of it. What are the kind of the symptoms of what, was he demonstrating any symptoms, you think?
Well, I don't think he had cognitive problems. If he has untreated prostate cancer, I don't think anything he had as a cognitive problem affects it. Obviously, his shuffling gait and other things could be due to other aging processes. We don't know. From what I understand, and again, we have limited information, he has limited metastatic bone disease as opposed to all over. So, again, is this hearsay or not? I don't know. So I'm not, it didn't help him, but I'm not sure how much it hindered his other, you know, he has a lot of other aging processes that are a threat to him.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, would, I guess the question is like, and not even from a cognitive standpoint, like you heard about that he was tired, like he was trying to do the debates and he was sleeping more. Like, I guess I'm asking, would they be some symptoms of a prostate cancer that is now kind of spread, like where you would feel fatigue? I don't know.
I don't think so. Interestingly, if he had advanced prostate cancer that was being treated, those would be some of the symptoms of the treatment.
Right. Yep.
But that doesn't sound like that was the case.
No, it's because whatever the treatment would be, that would start beating you up a little bit.
Some of the treatments of hormonal therapies can make you tired and things like this. But, you know, I know this doctor, I think his name is Dr. Gupta. He had all the PSAs on President Bush, Obama, and Trump, and it sounds and couldn't, I don't know how he got them, but apparently there were no PSAs on President Biden. So, it just looks like he wasn't screened.
Yeah, it's now. Do you think? And I mean, we're playing a guessing game, and I understand. And where this is just conjecture. Would it be one of those things where he just said, "I don't want it to be tested," or how much does the patient have in the decision process of getting a simple blood test?
Well, it's a great point. Our guidelines, the American Urological Association, and a lot of people do this in screening, it's called shared decision-making. You review some data with patients at certain ages, what are their comorbidities, and say, do you want a PSA test? And this occurs particularly in men over, you know, we push them harder under age 70, get the PSA, get in here. But over 70, over 75 in particular, we talk to patients and say, maybe you don't need, in certain situations, a PSA anymore. And sometimes they say, I want it. And sometimes they say, I don't. Some people are nervous about not getting a PSA. So there is a process of shared decision-making. My thing would be, I'm just not sure we should do that with presidents.
Yeah. No, I think this is where this is leading to, not by us, but this is what's out there in the news world. Was is it possible? Do we know for sure that he didn't have a PSA test and had been told that he might be dealing, you know, and at his age, maybe it was like, well, you know, you can survive a long time. My understanding, it's something that doesn't metastasize that quick. I guess that's the mystery now, because everyone thinks it's so absurd that nobody was giving this guy a PSA test. Now, I guess some people are saying he got one and they didn't want to tell us, but who knows, right?
Well, what I do know is I heard his last PSA was low. You know, for 11 or 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And that should have put him at less risk. So I don't know. The good news is that if he has untreated prostate cancer at this point, and his testosterone is fairly good, there are a lot of treatments just beside routine hormone therapy that can prolong his life with reasonable side effect profile for quite a few years.
Right. So you're saying, like, you know, regardless that, you know, he didn't have the PSA or whatever, that was going to be my follow-up question. So from this point on, there are good, like, because once people hear it metastasize to the bones, they're kind of like, oh, it's, you know, it could be game over. But what you're saying to the audience is, no, there's good treatments out there, and they can put him on a plan that can definitely extend his life. So, and please share more about that.
Okay, so prostate cancer is unique. It feeds on the male hormone testosterone. So when we take that away with medication and reduce the testosterone, the cancer actually can go into remission. and on the order of years, 2, 3, 4 years on average. So that's just with that one therapy. But in the last 15 years, they developed secondary hormone agents called anti-androgens that block 100% of testosterone expression. That has prolonged life as well.
Wow, okay.
We also have vaccines and other things called radiopharmaceuticals. And all these things have led to a prolongation of life, 3 to 5 years. And by the way, I'm talking good quality of life by and large.
Right. Okay. So, and that's important. What type of if it's and good quality life, that's key, because some of the, you know, and you know better than anyway, over the day, some of the therapies could really beat you up pretty bad. You know, Dr. Liu, you've been a physician for many years now. Are you, like, the pace of all these new therapies, as you think about your career over what, 3 decades, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, so over 3 decades, do you feel like it's accelerating these new therapies, which do give you a quality of life, or did you see that 15 years ago, like... Or do you feel like we are entering into like a new stage of a lot of good breakthroughs, or it's kind of like it kind of ebbs and flows like it always has over the decades for your career?
No, I would say it's a flow, not an ebb. With the last 15 years in prostate cancer, the changes come every 6 months to the point where in our Southern New Jersey practice, we actually have an advanced prostate cancer clinic run by myself and two of my partners that all our other partners funnel to, because the space is so complicated. It's similar to other cancers with immunotherapies that really have changed the dynamics of survival for difficult other diseases, like in our space, bladder cancer, melanoma, things like this are just dramatic improvements in survival with reasonable therapies.
Well, you know what? That's good. So that's great to hear. And if you're listening today, Dr. Liu is giving, people that are, going in for screenings or are dealing with this, there's a lot of great stuff coming out to help you. So I think, we've covered Joe Biden, prostate. We did a little bit of politics and the prostate. Now let me ask you this. What are you doing for Memorial Day, Dr. Liu?
Going fishing.
You go. Are you down the shore, as they say?
Yes, I'm down the shore in Avalon.
All right. See, you're living that's the Philly Memorial Day life. You get down to the Jersey Shore and you enjoy that weekend. Well, Dr. Liu, I want to thank you for coming on, and it was I appreciate your perspective. And I think, President Biden, this news actually is a great awareness, because when it happens to a president, word gets out there to get that PSA test, go see your urologist. And if you want to see a great urologist, you can see Dr. Liu. He's part of Summit Urology, and they have offices here in the South Jersey area. Dr. Liu, enjoy your day, and thanks for coming on the Kale & Company show.
All right. Thanks a million, Tom. Have a great day.
Have a good one. So, well, there you go. We even, the sense I got from Dr. Liu there is that it was odd that the most powerful man, he was the second most powerful man as the Vice President of the United States. He was President of the United States, and no one was giving this guy a blood test, a simple PSA blood test, for over 11 years. It's I could sense not sense the doctor was quite frank about it. He thought that was that a guy in his position should have been having this PSA test definitely regularly. And if you're at the you're serviced by some of the best doctors in the best doctors in the world, so it is a little bit of a mystery. Maybe there's nothing else to it, that, sometimes it's just the way life goes. He was 71 and, he felt he didn't need it, or his doctor was like, you're at that age. Because there is they stop giving you the test if you don't think that something about, like, if you your longevity is 10 years. I could have asked Dr. Liu about it. You want to get this information from him, not from me, that's for sure. But anyway, so if I'll say it again, if you're a man over 40 or definitely 50, start getting that PSA test and find yourself a urologist and make sure you're always taken, because prostate cancer is one of the biggest things that, if not treated, is one of the biggest things that take out men. So you got to be careful about that. So we're going to take a commercial break. We're going to be back. Thanks for joining me here on Kale & Company. We'll be back in a moment.
It's Kale & Company on demand from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the free Odyssey app.
Trump he's going after Harvard. He's going after Harvard hard. One of the rulings that Trump has made is that he's cutting off any student foreign visas to specifically for students at Harvard. So if you're a junior at Harvard right now and you're going into your senior year, you're screwed. You got to find another university or another college. It doesn't mean you got to leave the country. I think it is that you just have to go to a different school. This is a targeted attack against Harvard. Now, I'm going to go over that over the next, that's going to be the next discussion. And if you've been listening in, you have any questions about any of the guests that were just on, any of the topics we just covered, I encourage you to give me a call. I'd love to hear from you, get your opinion. I heard there's been some opinions in the chat room, which is always active for this show, which is great. And I'd love to hear from you. So call in and let's have a discussion. So let's talk about Harvard. I was actually listening to a guy named Mike Benz, and he was kind of explaining what's going on, what has gone on at Harvard, and why Trump is attacking them. Why would the president of the United States be so interested in going after a university like Harvard? And we're going to play some clips, and we're going to go through it. So this guy, Mike Benz, I'm going to give you a little background on him. He's a Trump guy. He was a deputy assistant at the Department of State. He's a communications guy. He's a cybersecurity guy. He's definitely MAGA. There's no doubt about that. And it's because he's MAGA, it's funny. I was kind of reading up on who liked him, who didn't like him. And, of course, you know, they're saying he's some of the people on the left were calling him an anti-Semitic, and you know, Mike Benz is Jewish, and he went to an Ivy League school. I think he went to Princeton, but I wasn't able to verify that. So that's a little bit of background on Benz, because we're going to start listening to him. He was saying his opinion is Harvard is ground zero for global leftism, and it's the epicenter for globalist financial and political operations, which are not in America's interests. Meaning, you know, Harvard is kind of running its own kind of, I don't want to say the think tank, because the think tank just issues papers and gives an opinion. He is saying that his position is Harvard is actively involved in influencing and using whatever influence Harvard has to direct political decisions, economic decisions across the globe. And that's his opinion. I've never thought of Harvard in those terms. I've always just thought of it as the most prestigious university in the United States, and a very, very, very difficult school to get into. But Donald Trump is going after him, and he's wearing down the brand. There's no doubt about it that Harvard has hurt its brand. And I think Trump is going to keep throwing shots at him to continue to knock that brand down. And that's what we're going to get into. So to give you an idea, is Harvard has an endowment of $50 billion. You know, the joke is it's not a place where kids go to get educated. It's a place where kids go to get indoctrinated. So that's not 100% true. I actually have two brothers who are Harvard graduates, and both of them are MAGA. But there is some truth to it. And Harvard has changed over the years too. It's always been a very liberal place, but it probably has gotten more liberal. And you're going to be shocked when I give you some statistics about how many foreign students that is in the Harvard that are enrolled at Harvard. I think it's about 27% of foreign students are the Harvard students. That's a lot for one university. Even the University of San Diego, University of California at San Diego, Chinese students there was, I don't know, like 20% of the population of the University of California in San Diego. 20% were from China. And, you know, I had heard a report that the University of San Diego had, I don't know, they had a paper or they held a conference or something, which the Chinese found insulting. And all those kids that were sent there were funded some way by the Chinese government, that they all lost their scholarships and they all had to come home. And that wasn't to punish the Chinese students, which they did, but China doesn't care. They're making a bigger point against the University of San Diego for getting out of line and saying something about them. But Harvard's numbers with that 27% of foreign students, I really thought that's a pretty big number. And Trump's going after Harvard. He's going after them hard. He's, you know, Trump walks into the, like, it's like a Hell's Angels bar. And Trump's going in. He's like, who's the baddest Hell's Angel? And he walks up and he punches him in the face. And Harvard is, of all the university systems, who are anti-MAGA, probably Harvard is the number one that wanted Trump out. Definitely anti-MAGA, and Trump's going for them. It's the head of the snake, and that's why he's going after him. He did the same thing when he went after U.S. aid, who was distributing all our money to these NGOs. I mean, that U.S. aid was a big arm of the federal government. Like, if you're going to go after the bureaucracy because they're the guys dishing out all the money, Trump went hard after them. Man, he's beat them to a pulp, and I think he's won that fight. It seems to be off the news, but when what Trump had realized from his last administration, like if you're gonna go after institutions inside of our government or Harvard University, outside of it, but kind of inside of it, you go after the big dogs and you go after them hard, because people were shocked in government how hard he went after USAID. People, if you're in the university system, if you're the president of Stanford or the University of Chicago, you're like, oh my God, he's going after Harvard. He's like picking out one school and he's picking out the biggest dog in the pound, and he's going after them to teach them a lesson. So the reason Harvard loves foreign students is foreigners have to pay full boat tuition. When you're an American going to Harvard, there's a lot of grants and there's a lot of funding and grants and loans and everything like that. But the foreigners, man, they pay 100%. I guess Harvard's got to be $85,000 to $90,000 a year. So they have to, they just write a check, and that's how it works. And I know that feeling. I got two kids in college, and writing those checks, they're big checks. So that's why they love these foreign students, because they pay full boat. And that's 27% of their population of the school. So that's a really nice cash flow coming from letting in all these foreign students. The other thing that people don't realize is Harvard has now become, with these foreign elites, these elite business people across the globe, I'm talking in India, in Russia, in China, all over the world, they also make gigantic donations to Harvard. These are, you know, America has rich people, and the world, the outside the world, in all these different places, and some of them are very poor countries, but the elite there are super, super wealthy. And what they do is they make giant donations to Harvard so they can then influence them to allow, you know, their kids, their cousins, their nephews, their nieces to all get into Harvard. And that goes on every day in Harvard, that these kids from all over the globe are getting into Harvard, which is very difficult to get into, because of these donations made by these powerful foreign elites. And we're talking big donations. The next thing I want to say is that it's not all about the Palestinian protests either. Trump's not going after Harvard just because, or Columbia, just for the just for what's going on in Israel and Hamas and Gaza. It's not all about that. Matter of fact, it's about a handful of things, and I'm sure it's personal too, because there were people out of these universities going after Trump pretty hard. But it's a little more deeper than that. So I'm gonna play a clip, and this clip from Mike Benz on why, what are the reasons that the Trump administration is giving for going after Harvard so hard. So let's listen to what Mike Benz says in this clip.
I'll have to go to a different university. Now, the Trump administration has said this is because of noncompliance with federal government edicts. They gave several reasons. Anti-Semitism was one. Harboring violence was another. Noncompliance with DEI edicts was another. Non-cooperation with efforts to reduce CCP and Chinese influence over the universities. They basically threw the kitchen sink at Harvard. And understand, coming into the Trump administration, Harvard is set to receive $9 billion in existing grants from the U.S. federal government. $9 billion.
Okay, there you got it. Harvard's about to get $9 billion from the U.S. government. Now, think of this. 27% of the kids they're allowing in are not even from the United States. You think Harvard, I mean, should be letting in more kids from the United States. They're tying up 27% of their enrollment for foreign students. That's unfair, especially when our federal government and our tax dollars are going to Harvard. And, you know, your chances of getting in are now down at 73%. Instead of being, maybe they have 5% or 10% foreign students, but 27%. And you're taking up all those other spots for American kids. I think that's a red flag right there. But one of the important things that Benz just says there is Harvard is not all about anti-Semitism, about the war over in Gaza. He rattles through the other things, because there's a lot of people, and there are some people on the right who are saying, like, you know, we're blowing the anti-Semitism thing out of proportion, making special rules for Jewish students. Anti-Semitism at Harvard and why Trump is going on is just one piece. Like he said, they're harboring violent actions, meaning these are students that are coming in, and a lot of them are foreign students that are doing these protests along with American students, but they're not turning them over to the police. They're not assisting law enforcement with stopping this. And we, as the American taxpayer, are paying $9 billion to see college students, you know, taking over buildings, blocking people from getting to their classes. The taxpayer, through Trump, is saying, hey, listen, lock these kids up, throw them out of school, discipline them. Just, you have to stop it. Kind of what we were talking about earlier with the president of South Africa. You want to do business with us? You got to start behaving yourself. So this is what the federal government is saying to Harvard. You got to start behaving yourself, because you're not doing what we need you to do, but you're still taking $9 billion from us. So it was continuing DEI. He's written an executive order. That is out of the if you're going to do that, you're going to lose your federal funding. Trump feels that they are continuing DEI. They're changing the names of it, moving it around a little bit, giving it the department, rolling it under another one. And he's not buying it. So he says they're not complying with that. Also, Chinese CCP influence is big, and it's really big probably at a lot of these Ivy League schools. They used to have these Confucius Institutes at the colleges and these universities, And a lot of them are going away, and that's they started to go away in Trump's first term. But anyway, he's like, get the CCP influence out of Harvard. Get it out of there. They are a rival of America. They are a competitor. Get them out of Harvard. So it's not all about the Palestinian protests. We just went through a list of different things that they're doing that are not complying with the Trump's executive orders. They're in a panic right now. And they're in a bit of a bind because they're in a bit of a bind because of all this money that by revoking these student visas from these Harvard kids, by revoking them, the whole donation money from these rich elites, if they're not going to donate anymore if they can't get their kids into the school. Because Trump's just pulled all the foreign visas. It's a great tactic. He's like attacking them where it hurts the most with the money, taking back the $9 billion and then discouraging foreign elites to even donate to Harvard because there's no benefit because he's now revoking the visas. Never mind all the existing students paying full boat tuition. He's bouncing them out of Harvard. I mean, this is a, as I said before, he's got into the dog pound and picked out the toughest dog and he's going at him hard. And you know, Harvard is, you know, it's an old institution. It was founded before the founding of our country. It's older than our country. And, the federal government, for whatever reason, many years ago, picked it as, you know, to pick it to be the winner. What I mean by that, if you have the federal government giving you $9 billion or it's as how much money they've given Harvard over the years, you're going to have great facilities. You're going to have great professors. You're going to have great marketing and advertisement around the brand of Harvard, especially if you've been picked by the government to get our taxpayer money. I never knew that we were so heavily invested in Harvard. Now everyone thinks that all this money is going directly to some lab to cure cancer. It's not. This money gets spread over some of the most biggest nonsensical stuff you could ever imagine. And I would think, you know, most of the big research is on different diseases or technologies or whatever are happening out in the ecosystem of business, where they're spending their own R&D money and they're developing their own products or whatever. And I'm not saying that all Harvard studies are a waste of money or anything like that, but this is a lot of money going to one school. And when you get all that money, no wonder why you got the greatest brand. Why you're the number one university, because you're being heavily subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer over every other university. The other thing, too, which is different, not only is there our tax dollars and the federal dollars coming in, but the foreign donations are huge. The ones we talked about going into Harvard, and even how much China has donated to universities. It's crazy. And who's bigger than China in donations to universities is Qatar. Qatar donates a ton of money. I'm sure they donate a ton to Harvard too. And that's to kind of get their worldview out there, their influence. And I probably would think you could tie some of the donations back to some of these Middle Eastern countries like Qatar that have led to some of these kind of funded pro-Palestinian protests at Harvard. I'm sure if you look deeply, that's where some of this funding comes from. So anyway, we're trying. That's getting cut off, and Trump seems to have a plan that is it's pretty punishing to Harvard. But let's go on to the next clip. Let's see what Mr. Benz has to say. I think the clip starts at 4:35.
Really, every center, institute, and department at Harvard is weaponized against the Trump administration at every level. Through their back channeling with intelligence, through the back channeling with the State Department, through their back channeling with the defense sector, through their back channeling with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, multinational corporations, through their back channeling with the NGOs. You gave the example of Erica Chenoweth.
Okay, so what Benz is saying here is Well, the most obvious thing, Harvard is an anti-MAGA operation. And when you think of the deep state, Harvard is up to their neck with all these different organizations that Matt Bentz, from our security, intelligence, Wall Street, Harvard is working against MAGA through some of the biggest, most powerful institutions in this country. And they'll do whatever they want. They're not pro-Trump. The last thing they wanted to see was Donald Trump winning the last election. Their heads must have been exploding at Harvard, realizing that this guy is coming back. And because, listen, they've spent a lot of effort and energy working with all these deep state characters and players to do whatever they can to undermine Trump. And I'm sure you could track there's things that have gone on with Russia, with Ukraine, and a lot of this kind of is these dastardly underhanded deals to kind of take Trump out, even from all the lawfare lawsuits with all those law firms supporting these wacky kind of suits to kind of take Trump out. I'm sure a lot of that kind of circles back to the Harvard Law School. And what's crazy is, I don't know how many people voted for Trump, 75, 80 million people who do support Trump, do support the kind of MAGA, Make America Great First kind of philosophy, that our taxpayers are actually going to pay to defeat ourselves. And that can be that's quite frustrating. And Trump's putting it on the front page now, what they've been up to. So let's see. Ben's has more to say. So let's go to that next clip.
With the Harvard Belfer Center, the Harvard Belfer Center is one of these heart of darkness places within Harvard that is tightly involved in organizing what they call nonviolent action, which is a total hoax term. It's whenever you say nonviolent action, what they mean is the end stages of a color revolution where violent protesters who are not killing people with machine guns, but are rather throwing Molotov cocktails in police cars and breaking glass and setting buildings on fire, but they're not killing everyone as they do it. They're simply destroying everything and terrorizing everyone. They call that nonviolent action.
Okay. So I got more from Ben. So basically, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to jump back to this, but I have a caller and she wants to comment on the Harvard, on the discussion. So there's more to discuss on Harvard, believe me. So I think we have Anna on the line.
Yes, that's right. It's Anna, O-N-A. Good morning. Thank you,
Anna,
for being there.
Yo, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm enjoying this. What I saw it popped on the board that you wanted to talk about what I'm talking about with Harvard. I'm not done. There's going to be more, but I'd like to hear where we are in the conversation. What's your comment?
Well, you have enlightened the world by saying what you've said. You know, people from Harvard, my doctor has happened to send his daughter there. They act above us. And I believe that most of us did not know that all that funding goes to Harvard.
Yeah.
I think it's about time that they know exactly who they are. They are not any better than you and me. All right. They may have funds to go there or we help them, the taxpayers. But they are no better than you and me, and they should be serving the people. That's what they're supposed to do, the people that go there, especially the medical field. So thank you for telling us about this. We didn't know. And I just wonder if this is going on, there must be a whole lot more that's going on that we don't know about.
Oh, yeah. Anna, I agree with you. I think there's and it's going to spread from Harvard to Columbia to the University of Chicago. The government is just too big and has gotten too involved. And then these universities pick a side within government to keep getting their funding and then act on their behalf to kind of serve their interests. And
they act untouchable. They act like they are beyond, you know, the regular masses. They are not. These people go there, especially, as I say, the medical field, to serve and help people, not to become multimillionaires and throw us aside.
No, it's...
This is way out of hand. I'm glad Trump is doing this. This is one thing I can say. Thank God he will make people see that we are all alike and need each other.
Well, well said, Anna, and thanks for coming on and sharing your opinion. And, you know, I agree with you. And it is, the good news is that Trump is taking this on. And it, the big, I'll frame it in the bigger battle of the Ivy Leagues and even corporate America to a certain extent and even Wall Street. They have, it's elitism. It's really elitism. They see this is a democratic republic. The country decides by who we elect as a leader. And the elitists, if you pick the person they don't like, they are going to use every institution, every taxpayer money, anything to kind of stop the American people from being heard or getting what they want to get done. And listen, Harvard and many of these big universities are ground zero for elitism. And elitism is kind of really, I would say, since 2000, the elite attitude in this country has destroyed so many things. And but you got a guy like Trump who kind of represents more of the Main Street entrepreneur and the working class. And he's the guy that's kind of pulling us back into the fight and kind of recalibrating or resetting the system. So that covers over, you know, from our trade deals, from gutting our manufacturing base. He's trying to reset the field for us, and he represents a different people. And obviously, it's kind of a working class against the elites. Not an extreme. I don't want to act like it's a giant civil war, but we are in a fight for this. And Trump's going after these big universities, and Harvard is the big dog, and he decided to go straight at him. So thanks for the call. The one of the things that Benz was just saying there is that, and this isn't going to make you happy either. Harvard is a training ground now for well-funded leftist protests. They have all these like institutes inside the university, and they're saying a lot of this upheaval and you wonder why, you know, how these things are so organized. They have their tents. It just seems like to run like clockworks when all these protests, you know, going back to Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and now the Palestinian conflict and all these green protests and everything, they pop up. They seem to be so well organized. And I would not be surprised if some of these institutes within Harvard and these elite institutions, they're actually teaching these young people how to do it. And now they're bringing in it's gone global. 27% of the students aren't even from the United States. They're bringing them and training them how to go against American policies that our president is trying to pass on our behalf and then asking us to write a check for $9 billion. We're paying for it. We're actually funding our opposition, and Donald Trump, hopefully he's going to put a stop to it. You know, this whole college conflict thing, I didn't think has legs. I think it does have legs, and I think we're going to learn more and more of what this university system was doing to people. And the pushback is coming, and it's already started, so that's a positive. I actually have, I think, if I'm right, Jimmy, I got one more clip of Mr. Benz. Is that correct?
Harvard is essentially a foreign policy tool that merges financial markets with intelligence and statecraft to impact global policy, foreign policy, and the domestic drivers of foreign policy, which include running out a president who might oppose a foreign policy that interferes with Harvard's bottom line. Harvard invests deeply and has since the Cold War ended. Harvard has been deeply invested through the Harvard Endowment in seizing Eurasia from Russia, which puts Harvard directly at the center of Russiagate. In the 1990s, everyone can look up a great article called The Harvard Boys Do Russia, or any deep dive you want to go down on a little place called the Harvard Institute for International Development and its role in privatizing and stealing the wealth.
So, yeah. This is a lot bigger than just a bunch of kids creating a little bit of trouble on campuses. This is a lot bigger than that, and that was the point I was trying to make earlier. But we're going to go to a break. Hopefully we can get a little bit more in on this Harvard thing, but we do have Charlie Gasparino coming up in the top of the hour, but maybe I'll circle back on this. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Start your day with Kale and Company, weekday mornings 6 till 10 on Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, and the free Odyssey app.